Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to a Monday, April 25th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Thomas podcast. Really, though, Misei and Thomas here on the Chase Thomas podcast because Philip Misei is back. My good friend Philip Misei is back on this very program. Great director, friend, writer, all that and more. And he's got a new film out, a short film that he put together last year that we talk about in this particular episode that we'll talk about all the important links there. But philipmisei.com is where you want to go for that trailer. Cleveland Film Festival, it's going to be all over. It's fantastic. And highly encourage you guys to go check that out and be ready for that. On the lookout as the summer approaches. But on this particular episode, we kick back into groove here because it's been a year since we last did our film review podcast, and man, I've missed them a lot. So being able to talk about movies again with Philip was an absolute delight, and I'm very glad to have that back in my life because it's important, and I think it makes me smarter and it helps me in a lot of ways. And I think it's just, we come at these films in completely different ways. And I think it's just really informing for me. And I think for the listeners too, because it's just, it's cool. Me being a sports guy and Philip being a filmmaker, and just two different lenses there. And I very much enjoy and treasure our conversations and where they go and what we gather from the films that we watch each week. So this one, Drive My Car, a Japanese film that is quite good that you can go check out on HBO Max right now if you have not already done so. A little bit lengthy, but just a really, really great film that very much enjoyed watching and talking about with Philip. So again, Drive My Car up next here on Philip Misei and Chase Thomas here on the Chase Thomas podcast. Folks, if you would like to watch this very program, guess what? You can do so. YouTube.com, type in the Chase Thomas podcast. That easy, that simple. Hit that subscribe button and never miss a video component here on the podcast. Also, yeah, there's more. I'm writing all the time now in one particular spot. Sports Renaissance Man, that's me. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. Type in your email, become a subscriber today, and never miss any of my writing on that front. I would greatly appreciate that. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. Also, if you're not already, go ahead and hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you get your podcast so that you never miss a future episode. But if you're already a subscriber and you have not already done so, go ahead and hit that pause button on your podcast player and leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you get your podcast. Helps other people find the show, and it helps this show continue to grow. So if you could do that today, I would greatly appreciate it. Follow me on Twitter, Chase_Thomas, and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. All right, we're back. Let's go.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen,
what happened?
Are we live?
We're live. I'm not cutting any of this,
okay,
by the way.
All right. Well, that's great. That's great. What's
you
up?
Had me at
what's
the ladies up, and gentlemen.
Ladies?
Yeah.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? And welcome back from a horrible, horrible hiatus from Misei and Thomas. It's been about a year. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Chase has blown up since then. He's just left me in the dust. I'm still in down here in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Chase is up there in Knoxville, Tennessee, doing big things, like getting syndicated, essentially. Mm-hmm. getting nicknames thrown around like Sports Renaissance Man, which is 100% accurate if you ask me. I mean, it's like How many sports? How many articles do you think you read a day on every like sporting event that took place? Like, I feel like you're just missing like cricket and water polo at this point.
Probably. So with my Google Docs, if I had to sort through what I would say probably 40 to 45, somewhere around there.
A day.
Yeah.
40 to 45 a day.
And then that's not even including the books that I'm getting through on a daily basis. So it's like I have a whole daily like reading log and a daily like book log and daily writing log. And yeah, no, the articles are a lot, but it's also just that like, it depends on what long form I read that day. So there is some stuff that can like throw a wrench in like how many different articles I read. So it's like if I end up going down a rabbit hole on like The Ringer or The New Yorker or something, then that might pull me from just really, really just going through all kinds of different 400 to 700 word articles. Like it just depends on what's happening.
Let me just get this straight. Are you getting your sports news from The New Yorker?
There are some really good sports columns in The New Yorker.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's some good stuff. But I mean, I don't like to only read sports stuff, though. Like, I need to make sure that I'm getting a healthy dose of things that matter and things that I want to be not an expert at, but just something that I have a working knowledge is the way I describe it. Like, I have a working knowledge in terms of things that matter.
things that are going on in the world. Yeah, you're just staying worldly. And by the way, I mean, I love The New Yorker. I feel like it's literally like you and I are probably the co-kings of hot takes.
Yeah.
I feel like every New Yorker article is just one steaming hot take. It's just like like some of the most pointed and voice filled writing that I think exists. Like so I would love to see what you're pulling from The New Yorker that you're you know resonating with on the daily.
I mean it's Meyer's always pretty pointed with, and I've read a couple of her books. I think Dark Money's right there. She's pretty good. I don't know, it's just, it's interesting because I like reading styles where it's like I can't write like that even if I wanted to. Like there's no part of me that is capable of writing anything like that. And I like reading people who I'm not worried of like, oh, we write alike, or there's a lot of similarities between the two of us. Because I think it's more exciting to read people that I just, it's amazing to see how their brain works and how they formulate and structure their stuff. And it just, it's interesting because I like reading writing that, like I said, just kind of varies from my own, and I can jot stuff down and I'm like, oh, this is fascinating. And I don't know, like it's fun. I like, what do you read?
Well, I read a lot of really sad books on like late stage capitalism.
Yeah. What's the latest one?
So I am making my way through. I really don't want to talk about this. I'm making my way through a book right now called Capitalist Realism.
Yeah,
and it's extremely dark.
Yeah,
I don't know why I'm drawn to these types of books because
your personality doesn't match it. And I tell people, and I told Samantha, I'm like, he's a bleak person in like in a lot of ways, and I think that's why Philip and I share a lot in common. Where it's like, I think my bleakness is probably more out there and more like people would not be surprised to hear that like we have kind of a cynical or pessimistic view on where things are going. But like you're just a happy, like your outwardly demeanor would not.
It wouldn't suggest that I spend my free time reading books about the way the world is going to end or the way that society is going to disintegrate.
Yes.
the way that all the antagonism that is that we're seeing towards democracy is coming to a fever pitch.
Well, but, see, this is why I would love to be on every one of your first dates. Like, just
this is exactly how they go, by the way.
Yeah, where you get to the meat of the conversation when you get past the basic stuff, and then they're like, wait, what, hold on, where are we going with this? And you're like 17 minutes in, and I'm just like, this is what I need. It would be a great reality show, Philip.
The hilarious thing is I read so much nonfiction that if I'm like having to either catch up on fiction or I haven't read a nonfiction book in a while, if anyone asks me what book I'm reading, like what novel I'm reading, my gut reaction will probably be Lord of the Flies. Because I'm either at some or Brave New World. I'm always at some stage of like rereading passages from Brave New World or The Stranger. Like, I don't know. I need to get better.
Mr. Albert Camus.
Yeah, he's there's a guy who
that's
had
on my shelf too.
Cheery outlook on life.
It's a good book though.
It's a great book. It's a great book.
Vonnegut's probably the more like I go back to a lot of Vonnegut stuff, where his writing is playful, but it's also very bleak and about where things are at. It is kind of funny, and this was decades and decades ago that we're reading, and it's like, oh man, but we're still here, right, Philip?
Yeah,
we're still here.
And look, a lot like one of the central pieces of literature of the film that we're going to read.
This is a good segue.
Many artists tend to write about very bleak things, and not least of which is this film and Haruki Murakami, who is one of the most beloved Japanese authors alive today. I actually read his book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Running, a few years ago, and absolutely loved it. It's essentially like a memoir that is not a memoir. I think he was very deliberate about, you know, classifying it as not a memoir, even though it does have a lot of memoir characteristics. But anyway, let's talk about film.
I was kind of all in on your book selection choices. I was kind of all in on that. And I also love that we're back, first video pod the two of us have ever done, and we've got the Atlanta stuff like all ready to go. So if people forget that we're both from Stone Mountain, Georgia, they will not forget based on our wardrobe and merchandise choices.
Oh, are we on? Is this podcast being posted?
Look at him, folks. He didn't even know that there's the YouTube channel everything.
I would have like cleaned up all of the stuff on my couch behind me, but look, this is in medias res as it gets.
Yeah,
like
you're seeing
me on a Sunday afternoon. I'm about to get off of this podcast and start doing work. So that's
what is work as opposed to not work.
Work.
Is work the one, the bill paying work or the not work? Which one? I love this. I just wanted to say work.
You love driving that screwdriver right through my carotid artery every chance you get, huh? We're not going to talk about my work. I'm for anyone who wants to know, I'm basically a spy.
Yeah. What about your work?
Oh, work is fun. That's okay. The fun word. It's like when you square something. If you like square a negative number, you get a positive number. But if you cube a negative number, it's still a negative number.
Mm-hmm.
My work is like a negative number squared, and so it's still like negative. Mm-hmm. But I kind of view it as like a positive because it's, you know, for various reasons. I'm a spy.
Okay,
don't worry.
Do your parents read anything that you're reading? Do you give them the books? Do you like hand them over and like you would love this?
No.
Hmm.
No, not at all. I don't even think I legitimately think that I'm the only person who reads the books that I read. Like, I don't know. Like, one of my favorite books is Brave New World Revisited, which is where Aldous Huxley, and I think this is like the 60s, he basically wrote an explanation of how everything he portended in Brave New World was basically becoming a reality. And there's like this one... There's this one chapter where he talks about how there's like the consumer like super brain and like brands like Colgate are starting to bring younger consumers into their sort of domain at an earlier and earlier age. And so I think this was around the time they started, like, brands started to come up with jingles. Like Stanley Steamer make carpet cleaner, you know, like that sort of thing. Jingles were expressly developed for the purpose, or, you know, this is what he alleges in the book, were expressly developed in order to essentially create these earworms in younger consumers, so that when you see a Colgate ad on TV, you associate that sort of sonic cue with like an immediate need to go out and buy, you know, Colgate toothpaste, or, you know, when you're in the store and you see like a tube of Colgate, you associate it with the jingle, and like that becomes the, you know, that becomes the impulse to buy that thing. And it's just, it's a really fascinating book, but Yeah, I could talk about this all day.
There you go. You know what's funny? So it's you want to talk about this all day, but do you like talking about this kind of stuff with other people is my question. Because I feel like this is one of your favorite things to explore and like one of your favorite things to read about and spend a lot of time thinking about. But do you actually enjoy if we were at a dinner party, Philip, and I was like, all right, this is my friend Philip. He loves reading about late stage capitalism.
And how democracies fail.
Right.
Yeah.
Would you be comfortable? Is that like the worst thing someone can say? Like when you walk into a room of like, this is what Philip is, his background is. This is his favorite thing. And here you go. Because for me, like when the worst thing that can happen to me is like, oh, what do you do? And it's like, oh, if someone introduces me as like, oh, he reads a bunch of sports all day and he covers a bunch of sports. And it's like, oh, no. That's the worst thing you can introduce me as. Because then.
Yeah, I know. You've told me.
Yeah, it's terrible. So I'm curious if that would be the same. Is it the same reflex where you're like, oh, this is not going to work for me?
Are you asking me, do I want to be known as that pessimistic guy who reads all those sad books?
It's not even not known for it, but do you want to have those conversations with like acquaintances? Like, is that something that you have any interest in having?
Oh yeah, man. I have like no filter when it comes to sharing my thoughts on things that I think are really interesting, even if they're like, a bit of, like out of left field, or I don't really know the best way to describe it, even though if they're non sequitur or not applicable to the situation, like if within 5 minutes of meeting someone, I'm like, oh, this would be a good person to talk about, I don't know, like, something that I'm reading in a book that I found really fascinating, then yeah, of course I'll bring it up. But I don't know, you'll have to ask the next acquaintance that I make what I'm like as a dinner party guest.
Okay.
I really don't know.
That works for me. I would be glad to do that. I would do like a whole spinoff of the pod. I think we have our spinoff ready to go. Philip, I wanted to go down that separate rabbit hole to see if you could actually segue seamlessly back into what you were trying to segue into originally. Can you do it?
Yeah. Well, were you just intentionally trying to derail me, or was just like an intentional sort of car crash that you were looking at sort of causing? Because
right,
you know, there are a lot of similarities, I think, between the trail that this conversation has taken.
Mm-hmm.
And the winding road that that the protagonist of the film that we're discussing today has taken, and it deals a lot with exploring our past and
right
who we are inside and how the world views us, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you want to talk about this film, or do you not want to?
This is going to be a happy film. Drive My Car. It was interesting. It was very soothing. Like, this was a very soothing movie where it's Philip Musée in a nutshell, where it's like talking to Philip is soothing, but what he's saying, it's like one of those things.
What are you about to say? Let me let me just for the record say that I don't want to be compared to the subject matter of this film. I don't want my essence as a human being to be described as grim or devastating or, you know, melancholy, which, by the way, were elements that made this film incredible. But for those of you who haven't seen Drive My Car or heard of it, as I was mentioning before, Drive My Car is a film adapted from a story by Haruki Murakami, who's a Japanese artist. It is a film that's written and directed by Ryusuke Hamaguchi, which is I believe his second collaboration with I want to get his name right, with Takamasa Wei. So they co-wrote the screenplay together, but this film was incredibly well received over the course of last year. It had its world premiere at the 2021 Cannes Film Festival, won the Palme d'Or, and it also won the Best Screenplay Award. And most recently, it won Best International Film at the 94th Academy Awards. And so basically, this has been... I recommended this film to you about a month ago. before it won. Excuse me. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was because I think we have this streak of watching. I think of the like 20 or so podcasts that we've done, maybe like three or four have been films that were like genuinely like happy. And even of those,
and that wasn't even by chance. Like, I think that's just our whole thing, is that's just what we're into. For like, that's my go-to movie genre, is in book genre, article genre. It's just, I don't know, I like it when it's natural like that, where it's it's an organic thing. We were not planning on just doing everything that was bleak and depressing. And I mean, Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Prisoners was my favorite. I thought that was a very happy movie.
Did you think it was?
That must say a lot about what I think is happy.
You love that movie. Find someone who loves Where'd You Go, Bernadette as much as Philip loved it. That's whoever that
person is my soulmate, because I think about that movie sometimes and I'm like, look, all she wanted was to stop the chaos inside of her, and to stop that chaos she had to create. I mean, how beautiful of a concept is that? I feel like we should just do a year of Richard Linklater.
I would do that.
I listened to his podcast. He did a live show with I think it was the Hollywood Reporter awards chatter, and I listened to this like 2 months ago, and he's just like the chillest dude. He's just like, and his voice is just like so soothing. He's just like, yeah, you know, I was going to class once, and you know, I was like, oh, that's like a cool thing that I could, you know, use for the film, and you know, so I did it. And I'm like, bro, I think he's a brilliant filmmaker, because he, and I've said this before, he just captures like the essence of everyday life, in a way that's like very, very wieldable. But anyway, apart from this, you know, group of, or style of filmmaking that I think we tend to center our podcasts around, Drive My Car fits squarely into this, sort of, dark but rich and deep exploration of human disappointment. And I think one of the things that I really liked about this film, apart from the acting and the pacing, was just the way that the shots of both Tokyo and Hiroshima captured this sense of like impending like an impending sense of self-examination that was never quite going to be realized. Like, I think by showing us Tokyo, showing us like these really like cloudy days, this like haze just kind of that hung over each of these cities, and we're driving through streets. It's like both of these cities are very quite industrious. There's the sense that you never, you know, things are always in motion, and we never quite get a chance to, but the characters that are in this car never get a chance to look inside of themselves until like a certain point in the movie where everything just starts to come out really naturally after they develop this, you know, this rapport together. So I really like the juxtaposition of that, like, hazy, like morose cityscape, which kind of, to me, like, captured a lot of the chaos that I think was going on internally with these characters.
Who did you think did the best job of acting that out and putting it out there on the screen, where you were like, you were probably most taken aback by how they were able to not articulate, but kind of express what that character was feeling?
I think this is, so that's a good question, because I think this is probably emblematic of a lot of the Japanese films that I've watched. One of my favorite directors is Hirokazu Koreeda, and a lot of his films are characterized by, you know, actors who don't really emote all that much. And so that theme of, you know, these characters like keeping in their trauma and not really like, at least outwardly expressing it in the same way that in Western culture or in Western films, you might see a character emote was, I think that was very much on display in this film. I think the main character, the you know, the theater director who had been, I guess we should also reiterate that we do spoil the film.
Yeah, we should say so. On these podcasts, yes, we do talk about the movie and everything that does happen in this movie.
Yes, so keep that in mind. So I think that Mr. Kafuku,
the main character, the guy who's helping him with his play in Japan, who has the wife who only speaks in sign language.
I think he's the dramaturg. So okay. So I'm talking about the main character who's you know, owns the car and he's being driven around in his red, you know, Saab 900 turbo. I think that he did a tremendous job embodying the pain of this man. For me, it was really hard. I didn't really get the sense that he had, holding in such resentment toward his late wife until the very end. I mean, you get the impression that, you know, after they lost their daughter to pneumonia, you know, they entered into this this stage of their relationship where, in order to survive, they essentially, you know, compartmentalize different aspects of their personalities. And, you know, she became really reserved. And he, I think, you know, misunderstood the reasons why she was pulling away a bit. And, you know, obviously with, you know, her infidelity and deciding that, you know, she was going to see other men and then him never confronting her about that.
Right.
I think as a viewer, you get the impression that, well, hey, like maybe he's either in on this whole situation, or he just doesn't have the courage to confront it. But it's not until the very end that we see that he does still harbor this, like, these pent up feelings of disappointment and resentment for his wife. And I think the journey that he took as a character from the beginning of the film to the end of the film, where he's, you know, he's doing his thing, he's in his element, he's directing this theater production of Uncle Vanya. You never really get a sense of all, like, the turmoil that's going on in his inner world until he's standing at the ruins of his driver's, you know, former home, and he starts to break down, and he basically, like, laments that he never had a chance to confront his wife about all of the things that, you know, seemed like, despite the fact that things seemed great, there was always this you know, layer of uncertainty and just ill will permeating everything. So yeah, I mean, that's a long way of answering your question. I thought he did a great job of holding everything in. Who did you think?
He holds it in until faced with someone who, like, the inverse is true, where he didn't have the chance to make amends before she was gone and before Otto departed. And who passed away from the brain hemorrhage, and he blames himself for some of it, where he says, like, I was driving around and I didn't want to go home, because I think we're left with the assumption that she was going to tell him about it, the infidelity and what was been going on, and that this is something we have to address. And mm-hmm. he did not want to lose the relationship. And like you said, even though he was going through all this inner turmoil, his feelings, his broader big picture feelings were still the same. He still wanted to make this work and loved the comfortability and loved her, like her mind. And he loved the car rides, and he loved when she would do the scenes with him, and do like the fact that the way she was innovative in the way very different folks in the way that she was a screenwriter, her methods were a little bit different. There's method acting, and then there is what she's doing, which is a different thing entirely, but hey, to each their own. But he loved that about
process.
Her. Exactly. And then his driver, who he becomes closer to, and part of that, I think, is because he says early on that, like, she could be his daughter. The age is close. So he sees, as he starts to open up a little bit more, that Misaki has her own trauma and deals with her own thing. But when she's faced with the realization that, or not even just the realization, but just that when she's there and she shows him her childhood home and what happened with the mudslide and everything like that, but, like, she could have saved her mom. And that level of vulnerability, where it's like, it's different than him, where he did not have the opportunity to remedy it. She did, and made a conscious choice to not do that. And I thought, like, the most devastating part of that back and forth was her talking about her imaginary friend, and just was wild. That's how she dealt with the physical abuse and what was going on with her mom. And man, that was probably the scene of the movie, was the two of them wrapping their head around their own unique individual turmoil that mm-hmm. has, like you said, just been gnawing at them for so long. They haven't addressed it, but for very, very different reasons. So I don't think he would have gotten there without her.
Without Misaki, his driver.
Yeah. I think he would have kept going the rest of his life, just doing more plays, doing more directing. Yeah. I don't think he would have ever addressed it.
Well, I guess the other extenuating circumstance was the fact that his main actor, the young man who played Uncle
Koji.
Vanya.
Mm.
Yes.
Can we pause real quick about this? I know what scene you're about to talk about, Mr. Koji. Okay. I want to get your perspective on this, because the sports renaissance woman came in at the, like, last 30 minutes of this movie and saw this scene. And I looked at her and I was like, this is the differences in Japanese policing and American policing, where this man... the back and forth, I was like, lawyer, what are you doing? Lawyer! Like, I'm shouting at the screen because he's opening up about it. And they're like, were you at this bar? And, well, the person that you got into the fight with, we saw you on camera, and that person has now passed away. And he's like, that was me. Okay, let's go. And then he's like, but one request, can I change first? Yes, sir, you may.
Yes.
What?
Look, I mean... He demonstrated some credibility, I guess, by first admitting to the fact that he did it, and then, you know,
he's like, "All right, play over." Like, sorry, like that's it. That was a wild 2.5 minutes.
Yes,
but it was also brewing. Where this movie being almost 3 hours, that's another thing about this movie, is that it cannot be. This movie could not have been done in an hour and a half. This movie could not have been done well. In that way, because you had to experience and sit with a lot of these characters for a long period of time. You had to see them interact with each other for a long period of time.
Yeah.
You had to really get a sense of who they all were, and, like, just even the dinner party, and those two just, they were so uncomfortable. You could just tell they were still just so awkward, and being around a happy couple and a happy home made them a little bit uncomfortable, and they were trying to get through that. And I don't know. I thought Koji was, like, the outlier, where he, like, the movie is about addressing this turmoil, and Koji was like, he was faced with it, but he had this understanding, I think, more so, than Misaki, where he knew what he was, and I think he tells him in the middle of the movie where he's like, there's nothing inside me. He tells Yusuke that there's nothing there, and Yusuke doesn't believe that. That's why he gave him the part that he did. It's like he wants him to experience what he experienced playing that role over and over again. And I think maybe I'm misinterpreting. I want to get your interpretation of it, but I thought him acting on that and him continuing to not be able to control his emotions was him just proving to him that, like, hey, this is who I am. I cannot change. Like, we can address it, yeah, but I have these problems, and self-control is just something that I'm not going to address, and I'm just going to be at peace with the fact that this is me.
Yeah, well,
it's a tragic character.
I mean, I think every character in the film is tragic in some way.
I don't know. Is it Lee Yoon? Is that the other director?
Yeah.
I don't think he's tragic. I think he's got a pretty good situation.
The dramaturg?
Yes.
I think the main characters in the film in some way, shape, or form are tragic, right? And that's Misaki, that's Mr. Kifuku. It is obviously it's Koji as well.
Yeah.
And I think those that sort of trio of characters are the only people who are ever in the car, right? And I think so. In that sense, the car is this like symbol of it's almost like this receptacle of pain, right? It's
yeah,
like it's the place where the most vulnerability, or it's the place of within the film where most of the vulnerability is on display. And so those are the three characters who sort of bear all, mm-hmm, in the film. And I thought the scene that you just mentioned, where he's Koji is relaying the story that Yusuke's wife Oto told him.
Yeah.
The fact that he Koji has the complete story, mm-hmm, and Yusuke does not. And I think we're meant to believe from the very beginning when Yusuke walks in and sees, mm-hmm, his wife Oto, cheating on him. You know, we only see the back of the head, yeah, of the.
It's implied it's him, though.
Yeah, well, it's implied, but I think through the nuance of the way that Yusuke and Koji interact with each other,
mm-hmm,
the way that Yusuke kind of looks after Koji,
mm-hmm,
and welcomes him with open arms and gives him the leading role in the play. At least, what was on my mind the whole time was, is Yusuke trying to sabotage Koji? Like, is he trying to, mm-hmm, exact revenge by putting him in a position where he's just like not, he doesn't have enough life experience to play the character, and he's, he's essentially setting him up for failure. And there's, the scene where, Koji tells Yusuke the rest of the story, and he's looking at the camera. I mean, it's a POV, it's Yusuke's POV shot. I thought that scene was so tense. Mm. It was so tense because I was just waiting for him to say something that intimated that he was the guy who cheated on him, right? And I think we are meant to believe that that Koji is this sort of sick, manipulative person who has a really nice sort of affect and smile and is very outwardly respectful, but he probably gets off on coming back to like the scene of the crime almost.
Yeah.
Like coming back and reacquainting yourself with the former husband of the woman that you possibly could have been sleeping with, and trying to develop this sort of strange friendship with him as a way of reconnecting with her lost memory. And
yeah,
I just think that there's a lot of complicated There's an extremely complicated dynamic.
Do you think that's conscious, though, that he's doing it? I don't know if we're supposed to believe that he's that smart of a character. Maybe that's something that I was thinking where I'm like, I don't know. It's like one of those self-destructive paths or really toxic personality traits that I don't even know if that person knows that that is their toxic trait and what they're doing.
Well, I think he admitted on more than one occasion that he had a problem too.
Right. But not what I'm saying is like seeking out the husband and really developing, like what you're talking about with the rapport and really driving the knife in a little bit on that accord. I don't know.
Well, I think it's one of the many things that can be left up to interpretation based on the acting of these characters, based on the fact that we don't really see Yusuke emote until the very end where he breaks down. And I think that's just probably, it's a testament to the directing and what I imagine would be the request of these actors to pen up a lot of the emotions that I think they would have had to be conscious of in order to put themselves in the shoes of these characters, like to feel something without showing that you're feeling it, and to feel something without knowing that, or to feel something while not giving away the difficulty of dealing with the weight that these characters are carrying around. I think that's a really difficult thing to do as an actor. So, the long story short, I feel like that scene in the car where Koji is retelling the story was one of the most tense of the entire film. I think everyone should definitely watch this, but like when you get to that scene, like hold on tight. Hold on tight.
And it's on HBO Max, folks, so you can it's easily accessible on that front. But I think there were a lot of tense scenes. What do you think was the most interesting question this film asked its audience?
That's I think for me there's a theme around how we accept people for who they are. Towards the end, I think part of the resolution of Yusuke reforming his opinion of his wife was grounded in Koji's question of, well, hey, like, do you think that it's possible that she actually wasn't a bad person and that she was in some ways like trying to tell you something about who she was? And then that was sort of reinforced by Kasuki's question of Yusuke when they're standing over the ruins of her home, isn't it possible that your wife, like you all, like you essentially that you both had a wholesome relationship. It's just that she loved you and also was unfaithful. And I think, I think that raises the question of, When people show you who they are and that image conflicts with who you'd like them to be, what is our role as a participant in that relationship? And it doesn't have to be like a romantic relationship. I think it can just be like a regular, it could be a platonic relationship. Mm-hmm. But when someone's actual behavior, contradicts the ideal of who you have of them in your mind, Is your role to like stand there and see them, even though you'll never be able to see fully into like the darkest parts of them? Or is it like was said in the film, is it a better use of our time to simply look at ourselves, like to look really deeply inside of ourselves, and try to intuit what it is about ourselves that that we still don't understand, because I think the point is made that you'll never be able to fully know a person. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's incredibly philosophical, and it's incredibly scary to think that. But yeah, that's was sort of my takeaway. What question do you think that the film brought up that's still unanswered for you?
I think that's a really good one, though. And it kind of permeates into a lot of other different questions that it mm-hmm. addresses. But I don't know. I think, like you said, I do like the fact that it really tackled the disparity between what a person presents themselves as versus what is actually going on. I thought Yusaki just did he was such a good casting choice for this role, because his face, it was just, he was always so difficult to read. And I think with that, it was just so much fun to follow along of just, you never know, even body language, even what a person's saying, you really, really don't know what a person's wrestling with internally. And I think just the people in his circle would have been surprised to learn where his head was at, generally speaking. And I also think the question it asked of just, we don't really move on. And I think that is something, like, closure is not a real thing. And I think a lot of films fall into that unfortunate pitfall of closure, because closure's neat. People like the idea of closure. I don't believe in closure. I don't think this film believes in closure.
That's good. Yeah.
So I think that would probably be another big question to ask of, like, what really is closure? Yes, she moved on, and Misaki could drive wherever. You can drive wherever. You can, your child can pass away to tragic illness, and time will go by.
Yep.
You may not think of it, that event, as much, but you don't even realize all the other ways that it still impacts you. And you cannot run from so many things in your past, in terms of, like, you can move forward, you can make progress, but there is no full closure. You don't ever know when that's going to pop back up, or something that you thought was remedied, or a feeling or a sentiment you thought was just fixed isn't fixed. It was fixed for that time. It was okay for that period of time, but it's kind of scary to think about how little choice sometimes you have in those internal feelings. Like, I think guilt was another part of this, is I think they both felt extremely guilty over the situations that kind of have defined their lives in a lot of ways. And it's hard to get over that. Like, yes, I would love to know what their lives were like after that. Do we just think that this film is saying, now that she's moved on and has a dog and went to the grocery store and is smiling, and that she's fixed? I don't think that the film's telling that at all. It's just saying that, like, for right now, this is where she's at, and she's made progress, and she's at peace, but peace can be shaken. And I think this film does a really good job of, you can be successful, you can play this role, and you can bounce around, you can travel, you can drive your car as much as you want to drive your car, you can read as many lines as you would like to read to block out what's really going on. Because I think that was part of why he was so intent on driving, not just the pattern and him reading his lines, but it was an opportunity for him to get out of his own head. And when he is playing that role and rehearsing these lines, he's not himself anymore. He's not having to deal with his own personal struggles anymore. He is in the head and in the mind of an entirely different person. And that was, I think, comforting for him. And he realized that, oh, if I'm not driving my car and I'm not doing my lines, then I'm going to be I'm going to have to address some stuff. And that's part of what she did for him as the driver, is, like, she threw his life into a spinning mess. And I think he knew that was a possibility, and it ended up helping them both, but it helped them both in the short term. We don't know what the long term is. And I think that is something that's important for people, is closure is temporary, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think the answer to what happens in the long run is actually embedded in the play.
Mm.
I think the very end where Lee Yune's character is she uses Korean sign language.
Mm.
And I thought that I think she was probably my favorite actor in the entire film. This is Urim Park, and she essentially is a Korean woman who does not speak, but she can hear. She's an actor. She was a former dancer. She had a miscarriage, and she just, I guess, lost her ability to be in touch with her body and found a way back into herself through the art of storytelling. And in her audition, I'll get back to the point that I was addressing in a second, but in her audition, she's speaking to the character of Uncle Vanya. She's playing Sonia, Uncle Vanya's niece, and she's signing so emphatically and eventually starts to cry, and the camera just sort of lingers on her for like a few seconds, and you can see that even though she didn't speak any words, you can see that something inside of her is just screaming.
Mm.
And so in that way, the play, once Yusuke gets sort of roped into the role of Uncle Vanya, Sonya's character has, you know, played by Urim Park.
Mm.
She has a signed monologue where she's essentially, you know, answering Uncle Vanya's question, like, what is the point of living, right? Like, what is the point of staying alive? And her response is, you know, we have to carry on through the suffering, because once it's over, and once we're, you know, once we're part of the great beyond, and we're face to face with God, and you know, God will have pity on us because of all of the suffering that we went through, and now that will be, you know, that will be the time to rest. But until then, we have to live our lives. We have to carry on. And I think the point that you brought up of, okay, well, yes, now that Misuki is, she's in possession of the car and she's driving around, she's at a grocery store, she has a dog, right? Like, I think that's a capitulation of the ideal that the play is you know, ends with, that life is suffering, and Misuki's not going to, you know, even though she probably had some degree of closure, she's not ever going to, you know, she never got to say goodbye to her mother.
Right.
She never, you know, she never experienced, you know, a proper sense of closure. And yet she still carries on. And I think we're meant to believe that, that Yusuke also carries on. And in many ways, you know, I'm sure that, you know, Koji's carrying on in his own way. Like, everyone experiences struggle. But it's not our job to, like,
as of right now, he's admitted to like 9 more murders since he's been in that holding cell. No, kidding.
That would not be surprising. That's actually the sequel.
Mm.
Yeah, the return of Koji.
The Koji murders.
The Koji murder, the Koji tapes, yeah. But yeah, I think this is a deeply philosophical film. The fact that the camera doesn't ever really, apart from the camera being in the car and following, you know, following the sob while it's driving through the mountains, the film is very static, and it's very stark. There's virtually no soundtrack. And that just forces us to be, you know, transported into the psychology of these characters and into, you know, trying to figure out what's in their heart. And I think that's part of the magic of why this film works so well. Like, we have no choice but to look at these people, like, look at these people looking at themselves. And it's really scary. It's really scary because I think a lot of the trauma or turmoil that they're experiencing is probably not dissimilar to the trauma that we all have experienced in some way, shape, or form. And our refusal to reconcile with that trauma is, I think, what's on full display in this film. So I'm getting in my head. Scary. Quite scary.
Being okay with that understanding is difficult. Like, I think it's just that's just not what human beings want to hear. They want the neat answer. They don't want to face that realization that this is something that you're going to deal with every single day. It is just something that's just a part of life, and it just is not going to go away. You can drive your car, you can recite your lines, you can act in plays, but it's there somewhere, and you just have to work at it. You're human. You just have to figure it out as you go, and that's uncomfortable. Like, this is an uncomfortable movie about uncomfortable things.
Yep. And also, it's incredibly claustrophobic, too.
It is very claustrophobic.
It's so claustrophobic. I think that adds to the, that just adds to the, like, unbearable pressure of, like, I don't know, being invited to look at oneself.
Mm.
It's like, well, you can, like, it's one thing to look at yourself in a mirror.
Mm.
And I think it's another thing to be put in a box of, mm-hmm. So, you know, surrounded on all sides by mirrors, and that box is traveling at like 70 kilometers an hour down a highway. You know, I think that's probably what Isuke was experiencing when he was assigned the driver, which is why we saw such resistance. Like, he didn't really want to have to look at himself.
The rule book there, they were very stringent, and there's not a lot of back and forth, where it was not a let me talk to your manager type situation. Let's go above board here, because yeah. Me driving this car, because I feel like he had a lot more cachet. It's like, what are you going to cancel all this? You've invested a lot in me coming here and putting on this production. And the rationale, wasn't it just that someone had hit somebody while driving?
Yeah.
And that was, and they were like, after that, never again.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense to me. That's
but then what if the driver does the same thing a couple years later? Do you get
a driver for the driver?
That's
you get two drivers.
You have two drivers in the front seat, and the person in the passenger seat's the one who committed the manslaughter, and they point to the new driver of like, here's what you want to avoid as you're driving.
Yeah,
driver inception. I'm here for
it. It's so meta. Did any of this even happen? I mean, did the movie even happen?
I think so. It was, I had not thought about the fact that there was no sound for a lot of it until you said something, where I had not even realized just how quiet and how limited it was in that regard, because it was a 3-hour movie, and it was just, I don't know, I for whatever reason, had not thought about that, of just how quiet the movie really was, which I think was by design.
Oh, yeah. When they drove off, when they visited Misuki's hometown, home village, and they pulled off, I think they were like pulled off the side of the road, and you know, to buy flowers, and the sound just went silent. It was ethereal. It's just like, here you're driving through this, you know, winterscape of just silence and desolation, and it was just very eerie. I ultimately really liked it. I really liked this film.
Same. It was good, and it only made sense that when we come back and get back into our rhythm and shake the cobwebs off, that we do a 3-hour foreign film from Philip Musay. But do you know what this means, Philip? Is it's my turn. This
it's your turn. Week. What do you got?
I think we do Fresh, because I really need you to watch Fresh.
Oh, you want to do Fresh? I didn't. Okay, all right. I'm down for that.
I just need to know, and I think the sports renaissance woman needs to know what your perspective on this movie is, because it's a wild ride.
Look, I'm all for wild rides.
Before we go though, Philip, I think something else that happened in the year in between that we're calling this the in between years, from Musée and Thomas was that you were busy and created your own. What do we want to call this? What's the actual term?
Short film.
Short film. Okay. I was going to say short film, but I wasn't sure if that was like the best way of describing it. But you did a short film. You were in Cleveland. Explain what happened, why you were in Cleveland, what the film is, how people can go check it out, like all that good stuff. Let's let the people know.
Yeah. Well, here I am about to sign off without even talking about my recent film. So I made a short film about a black inventor named Garrett Morgan, who was born at the tail end of the 1800s and moved to Ohio in the early 1900s, and basically apprenticed for a tailor shop owner. He became really adept at repairing sewing machines, and he eventually opened up a tailor shop of his own. He started a hair straightener business that he made quite a bit of money from. And he really just made a lot of inroads for African-Americans who were, you know, sort of migrating to Ohio. And the film itself is about an incredible sort of heroic event that Garrett was, Garrett was responsible for saving several lives when there was this explosion underneath Lake Erie it's hard to explain if you're not like looking at a schematic of the lake, but basically they were trying to bring in fresh water from the lake into the city, and someone who was mining hit a gas pocket and the whole sort of tunnel exploded. So there's this like inferno of like burning gas underneath Lake Erie. And he had invented this safety hood, which he had tested, and it was, you know, it proved that it could filter noxious gases. And he was going around trying to sell this safety hood and wasn't really having any luck, because once potential buyers and firefighters found out that he was African-American, they just didn't believe that it worked. So during the tunnel disaster, someone, I guess, had remembered that he had these hoods, and they asked him to come down in the middle of the night. And Garrett called his brother Frank, and they go down and they descend into this inferno, and they rescue several lives, and they help recover bodies after the rescue had been called off by the local fire department. And so the film takes place the morning after that happened. And it's essentially an argument between Garrett and his brother Frank about, you know, why he should continue to make these hoods if he's not, you know, he didn't get the credit that he deserved. Should mention that after, you know, the morning after, the newspapers left him out of the story entirely. So, you know, it's this philosophical debate between, you know, a man who is trying to go around and do this amazing thing and save lives, and his brother who has a perspective on, well, hey, like, why don't you apply yourself in different ways to sort of support the African-American community. So we made the film last summer. We were in pre-pro for like 6 months. We shot it in Atlanta for 2 days and then did like 6 months of post-production. I wrote and directed it and produced it and edited it. And now it's making the rounds at some festivals, which is super exciting. I wish I'd known that you're like putting this on YouTube. Otherwise, I would have put my last name on my name.
No, they'll know because your name will be on it. Like, we'll like in the actual.
Oh, it is called Musée and Thomas. But you can find the trailer for the film at my website. It's Philip Musée. Philipmusee.com. And yeah, we're having some success right now, and hopefully we'll be able to, you know, expand it into a bigger piece eventually. So it's
and
super exciting.
What is it called again?
The film is called The Inventor.
Okay. I could have to circle back. I've named my own post-production, but I'm 93% certain you didn't say the name of the film in that.
Yeah, I don't think I did.
It's amazing. I love this.
We're just talking about this, like, really, I'm just, like, so in my head right now because this film that we just discussed. I'm like,
yeah.
It was a lot deep. Like, I watched it and I was like, wow, this is deep. But every time you and I talk about films, it just helps me unlock a different layer of depth, and I'm stuck in the sunken place right now. So I'm trying to bring myself out of it. But yeah, the film is called The Inventor.
Yes.
Definitely check it out. Well, you can't check it out now because it's being submitted to festivals, but very soon I'll have a link to it on my website and you can look at it.
Is it going to play at an Atlanta festival anytime soon? Local one or no?
Yeah, it's actually playing at the Georgia Shorts Festival next Sunday, which is it's playing at Pond City Market.
Okay, what time?
The name of the theater. I literally don't have any details. I think they're like coming out with the schedule this week. I'm so in the dark on this, but I wish I knew the information to that question.
It's okay, but folks, the answer to that question. I think we're gonna have a lot of local Atlanta people and who check out this podcast, so I want to make sure that they have the opportunity to go watch it and go see it and go support you, man, because when I saw that was coming out, that's what you're working on, it made me very happy because you're very talented and I respect you for a multitude of reasons, but one of them is that you really, really put the time and the work in. Like it's cool to see, and I as someone who also just puts a lot of time and effort and energy and creative energy into things that we're passionate about that are important and that are just different, and telling different stories and working on different things and bringing a different perspective and different ideas to the table, I think is fun and thought-provoking. It makes you better. So I think this podcast between the two of us, I just think we both get something out of it that is very different, I think. But I think it's so helpful. Like the podcast after this, like now that we're back, like I can't wait to see what I'm like all week on future on the sports pods. Like I don't know, but it's so much fun because I always learn something and I feel smarter every hour after this. It's great.
That's all I can ask for. At least you don't. Well, you can feel smarter and maybe a little bit more. I don't know. hopefully smarter, but not more cynical. I love filmmaking because it makes me wildly optimistic about like the possibilities of where we can go. So even when we're watching films, and I'm assuming this next one is going to be very dark. should we just name the podcast like Philip and Chase talk dark films? I don't know. Like, is this something to that effect?
Eventually we'll do a I don't know. You can email
us. We should do Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Say it again?
Chitty Chitty. We should review Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Absolutely not.
That's like one of my favorite
movies. I'm not a musical guy. I cannot.
That's a problem.
Is it a problem? Are you a big musical guy?
Big musical guy. An American in Paris? You don't like that one? Okay, obviously you don't like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
No.
We could do...
I listen to jazz and like I don't like a lot of words to my music. Like I listen to a lot of stuff. Like I listen to a lot of musical soundtracks or TV and movie soundtracks, and like the John Williams of the world and the Doyles, and I don't know. I really, really like that. I work throughout the day with soundtracks that don't have words, and then I listen to a lot of jazz while I'm reading and doing other stuff and writing. So I don't know. I don't like a lot of music with words. So musicals don't really work for me because it's a lot of words and they're singing and dancing and just the energy level is not consistent with where I'm at on a daily basis, generally speaking.
All right, well, we'll move you away from that position as over time. I'll ease you.
Is that
into,
a goal?
To,
why do
to
you
musicals?
Need to do this to me?
I think
I'm
we've talked about this
man.
Before.
I'm 31 now. I'm setting my ways. Musicals are going to be a tough sell for me.
Look, I'm going to do my best to bring you over to the side of fun. Fun and just the human spirit is a musical. You look inside. All right, we need to stop now.
I know. I don't know. I didn't know where that was going. That was terrifying. Philip Musay, we can find you on Twitter at Philip. Is it just Philip Musay?
Yeah, just Philip Musay.
Yeah, there you go. PhilipMusay.com.
I should start using Twitter.
Well, your Twitter is locked, which is
Yeah, it's locked. Look, I'm the worst public-facing figure ever.
That's a good thing. I want to be, like, I think I'm pretty terrible these days because I only use social media really for promotion and getting my stuff out just because I have to. Like, I'm forever linked to social media because I don't think any of this works and any of my life works without it. But I hate it. And whenever I get my stuff and I schedule my stuff, I'm off. It's just it's a horrible use of your time. Horrible use.
Not my favorite. No. I'd much rather be reading Camus.
Exactly. Like, that's just Putin. Not like, people who engage and like want to have back and forth and discussions. It's such a waste of time. Like, at Twitter and all of that, it's just such a waste of time.
Hot takes.
Philip Musay.
Hot takes.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, sir.
Excited. This I think we need to nail down a day that this goes live. We can record on different days, but like which day we want to put these up every week as we do these again. I have an idea. I'm thinking Sundays. We recorded this on a Sunday afternoon, but I think if these go up early Sunday morning each week, just a good way for people to start their week on Sundays, I think would be good. But we'll talk about it. Philip Musay, Chase Thomas, we're back. Musay and Thomas. Go watch the movie if you've not already done so. It's on HBO Max.
Yes, sir.
Drive My Car. It's very good. And I will talk to you next week.
Yes, sir.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of Musay and Thomas here on the Chase Thomas Podcast. Thank you again for tuning in to this edition of the special format here on the Chase Thomas Podcast. So this will be on this feed on Monday mornings going forward. So look out for that every Monday morning here on the Chase Thomas Podcast. Musay and Thomas will be here. All of our new movie reviews, that sort of thing, will come on this very feed. And make sure you follow Philip at Philip Musay. And please go check out philipmusay.com and all of his great work and his short film. And let us know what you think. Email us, chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. So very excited to have Philip back. And I hope you guys enjoyed this very podcast. And if you did and you have not already done so, please make sure that you leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you get your podcasts. Don't forget, folks, new program coming out tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. Always new content for you guys on a multitude of levels. So excited to bring that to the forefront and to continue adding all kinds of great stuff for you guys this week. So thank you, as always, for checking out this edition of the podcast and the show. And if you're not already, please make sure that you go subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com, the Chase Thomas Podcast. That easy, that simple. Please go read my writing and all my sports writing, movie writing, TV writing, all that good stuff. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com, personal essays, all that and more. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. Type in your email and go ahead and hit that subscribe button there. But yeah, a lot of different links, a lot of different ways to access my content and all that good stuff. But go ahead and do that today. I would greatly appreciate it. And yeah, I'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Uncle Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.